From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach.
How well do you really know the piece of land on which you live and garden, or the bigger landscape context it sits within that forms your neighborhood, perhaps? A new book I've been reading called These Trees Tell a Story, The Art of Reading Landscapes, takes the reader along on explorations through a diversity of places, looking for hints on how to know thy land, as its author, Noah Charney, suggests. Noah is an assistant professor of conservation biology at the University of Maine and co-author with Charlie Eisman of the award-winning field guide, Tracks and Sign of Insects and Other Invertebrates, one of my much-used favorites. On the website of the publisher of Noah's latest book, Yale University Press, it describes it as deeply personal masterclass on how to read a natural landscape and unravel the clues to its unique ecological history. So I'm glad to welcome Noah as my guest today and learn more. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Good. You taught a course, I think, that kind of this book, the idea of this book kind of derives from a course that was called, I believe, Field Naturalist. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And in that course, every week we'd go out to a different site on the landscape and we'd take the van to some spot that the students really wouldn't know where they're going. And they'd encounter a mystery, like the trees would change on one side of the line to the other or something, or be some pattern that we would then, the students would have to discover what was driving that pattern, what caused it. And they'd just have a few hours or the rest of the day to uncover all the forces that came to tell the story of that site.
It's fun, kind of, the forensics. And I should say, I know your collaborator on your previous book, The Field Guide, Charlie Eisman, and I know you two have taught animal tracking and all kinds of other things over the years as well. And so you're kind of very astute observers, but I didn't know until this book that you were an astute observer of this much larger level. I mean, I guess I should have inferred that, but you know what I mean? I knew more about that. You knew what kind of spider made what kind of web and what kind of cocoon and animal track and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't, honestly, like neither of us really knew anything about insects or much about insects and invertebrates before we wrote that book. We were studying animal tracking and we realized that no one had written one about insects and invertebrates, so we took a deep dive into that. And Charlie now is, as you probably know, has gone really far into leaf miners and galls and knows a lot more about that. But neither of us started out on that path. We're just sort of curious and naturalists, generalist naturalists. I mean, Charlie went through the field naturalist program at UVM, which was the basis for the course that I taught too.
And so right.
Very much generally trained and interested.
Right. So curious is a good word. And early in the new book, you tell an anecdote about hiking with a friend, I think it was near Boston, and you eventually come to what I think is referred to as a greenway, sort of a bike path with narrow strips of green alongside. And you describe it, this quote, invasive, dominated, degraded ecosystem. But then you walk a while longer and you notice some particular trees and you close your eyes. So tell us, in that kind of a situation, what do you see with your eyes open? What did you see with your eyes open and what do you see with your eyes closed? What goes on in a moment like that for you?
Yeah, I mean, with my eyes open, I see the non-native species. I see the asphalt and the kids with their strollers and all the hum of the city life there and the way it looks like a very, very human created landscape that could be anywhere. But then when I noticed there, in that case, I think there was a particular like a silver maple and maybe a cottonwood, if I'm remembering that.
Yes, yes.
And I close my eyes and I think back to like those species are floodplain trees and live in very wet soils. And that probably was like a riparian wetland there before it became a bike path. And sort of closing my eyes and seeing, picturing like, and hearing the wood frogs and spotted salamanders breeding in that wetland there before it was turned into this bike path with all the kids and their strollers and such. And sort of seeing that echoes of that ecosystem are still there. And the soils beneath that bike path are still sort of created in the way that would facilitate those sorts of species. So,
right. So as gardeners, we think someone says, what kind of soil do you have? And we've frequently talked about like what we've almost made in our raised beds or something, and it's not what kind of soil do you have takes another level of meaning in the kind of explorations you're talking about in this book. It's really ancient and underlying and so forth, the thing that defined the place over a long period of history, yes?
Yeah, and the way I see it too, it's like it helps us maybe move away from like good versus bad soil, but it's like, what is the soil? Maybe it isn't perfect for the plant you had in mind for growing, but it tells a story of like all that's important about that place and all the plants that would have grown there naturally and the things that, you know, it's very good for something and it came from a particular set of circumstances and there's a story behind how that stuff came to be there.
Are there places that we, so speaking of soil, the topography of a place, are there references, are there places where we go look that we can get some of this old information, or, you know, are there surveys and are there, I mean, we can give some links with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com, but just so that I know what references to recommend to people.
I mean, it depends on which layer you're talking about, which, so at the sort of a larger scale, of course, there's the USGS surficial geology maps and or bedrock geology, both of those. Like the surficial geology maps for your local, I was just looking at New York State has some published and you'll see like what are the glacial landforms and at sort of a coarser resolution, like your neighborhood kind of area, like what's created those soils. But then at a very local, like, you know, this side of the hill versus this side or very small scale, like that bike path. I mean, those aren't necessarily going to be mapped on the geologic surveys, but you might have topo surveys and stuff. And there may be some, natural communities inventories that might map some of those things, but you know, at that scale, it's more about knowing the trees and knowing the plants and knowing how landforms create micro little ecosystems. And
well, like slope, you talk about slope in the book, and you know, I live on a hillside, so I don't know if you live in a flatland or on a hillside or whatever. But what about slope? What does that tell you as the type of investigator, curious person, but with your knowledge that you are, what does slope tell you?
Well, I mean, there's the biggest influence of slope, or one of them is, you know, the angle, the aspect, which direction it's facing, right? Like, is it facing south or is it facing north, right? And that has a big impact on the soils, as folks know. In the northern hemisphere, the sun is always in the southern part of the sky, so those south-facing slopes tend to dry out and be really hot, and the north-facing slopes are cooler and moister and create different conditions for different sets of species. The slope itself, you know, creates drainages, and you know, up higher on the slope, you have less soil buildup. It tends to be an erosional zone, and then down at the bottom is where there's a depositional zone. So you have more layers of soils and sort of more get towards the wetland soils more frequently down at the lower slopes. So there's a lot of different elements that go into that.
Right. And again, lived on a hill for a long time, and I don't really think about it. Do you know, I think about what I, and I'm a lay person, but I think about what I call air drainage. I think about the fact that the town that we call the flats below me get colder in prolonged cold moments, like overnight and so forth, than I do, because I think the air drains up over where I am or something. That's my very, again, amateurish interpretation. But you know, I think about that, but I hadn't really thought about well drainage, you know, the drainage area. And then also, like you said, what's deposited, you know, that there's less soil up there and more soil down below, and generally speaking, and so forth. So,
it's very like context and site specific too. Like, yes. I mean, my house, you know, where I spent most of my time in Western Mass is, we live right on the shore of a glacial lake deposit. So 10,000 years ago, there was a glacial lake there, and down below in our yard is essentially lake bottom sediments. And we walk up the hill and we get above lake level, and suddenly it's glacial till. And that change is really dramatic. And there's no rocks in our yard, but there's lots of rocks up and above us.
And that's where I am. My neighbors all say, well, how do you grow all those plants? You have such rocky soil. And I'm like, no, the rocks didn't land here.
Yeah.
You know, and yet they have them. So you know, the the book has the word trees. These trees tell a story is the title, and mm-hmm. and trees. So you look at things when you come to a place, you look at things like whether the canopy trees and the understory trees are the same or different, for instance. Tell me a little bit about that, because that's another interesting thing that I hadn't really thought about being a closer observer of, and that's silly, but I hadn't.
Yeah, no, me too. And it's one of those patterns that it's so easy to see once you start looking for it. But like, I and almost nobody really ever started out looking for that. And foresters know it. But basically, the idea, it relates back to the idea of forest succession, which is, you know, if you clear a field, a certain set of species will come out into that field around, you know, Western Mass and New York. Often it's white pines is one early successional species. For 100 years or so, they'll grow up, and then oaks will be the next generation, and then maybe hemlocks or sugar maples will be kind of like that climax successional stages. So there are these, over centuries, these sort of waves of different species that come through as a forest develops. And so when you walk into a forest and you see the canopy is all white pines and the understory is all, say, you know, red oaks, that if you pause for a second and think about what will happen in 100 years when those white pines die, it'll be a canopy of red oaks. So that tells you that the forest is still in transition, and it tells you, you know, something about the past of that forest and something about where it's going in the future.
In the start of the book, you tell the story of a couple. You kind of take us in each chapter through to a different place. And like, I guess you took your class to a different place to solve mysteries every week.
Yep.
In the start of the book, you tell about this couple, you know, who are considering cutting down a bunch of trees in their yard for various reasons. They need more light, they want to have an orchard, and they need to install a drainage ditch because at least one of the trees is rooted where there's persistent water and the wet soil is damaging to the foundation of the house and so on. But you kind of talk to them about it, you get in a conversation with them about it, and you say, I'm going to quote in the book, you say, "The pines, the oaks, the mud, the water, the land, it's not random, but all part of a long unfolding story that you have a role in. Dig up the details," you tell them. And then you suggest they look both into the past and into the future for details. So is that that's kind of the exercise, roughly?
Yeah, that is it. I mean, like, really, before, and for them, and before they start to like fight their soils and like have like just come in with their vision of what they wanted in their yard, absent having, like, before they had even bought that house, you know, start right. by like looking at the landscape, looking at the, you know, the canvas that they're now living on, and really understanding it. And so that maybe the hope is that, like, instead of fighting against it, we can find ways to work with it, because, you know, understanding where it comes from, the long glacial history, and then, you know, as you manipulate your landscape, you're going to be affecting it, you're going to be affecting your neighborhood and all the species that come to visit. And so what is the context, what species are around, and where, what might take refuge here or in your neighbor's property?
Right, because you talk about excuse me, the ripple effect that each action we take has throughout the whole ecosystem, not just our property line, but way beyond that. That ripple effect.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, I have a nonprofit that I run down in Nashville, and a lot of work, you know, people are so focused on their parcels and laws and policy, and everything is focused on parcel by parcel and our house by our, you know, lot by lot. But really, the species, the ecosystems, they're not worried about these property lines, and trying to work beyond those and work on sort of regional area sort of planning is really important. So.
Yeah, I think, I guess it was probably Doug Tallamy at University of Delaware who's told me the expression conservation corridors, that you know, that we're all connected, and, you know, these contiguous areas and so forth, it makes a corridor potentially for conservation efforts or to support. Yeah, yeah. One interesting thing is that I don't remember which chapter it's in, but you also seem to express some nostalgia in a way or whatever for the thickets or hedgerows of, you know, what we all term invasive things, like, you know, multiflora rose or bittersweet, oriental bittersweet, things that we see along the roadsides or maybe even have at the fringe of our own garden, and things you call messy invasive thickets. yet you also seem a little conflicted about just trying to beat them back and erase them as is the mandate these days. Can you just kind of talk about that? Like when we're looking at the now of a place, which frequently in a lot of the country, because of all the disturbances in our history of our nation, well, every nation, has been changed, has been greatly changed. So, and is frequently a mix of native and non-native, and sometimes the non-natives have the upper hand.
I'm definitely conflicted. I have different minds on different parts of me, think different things. And I will say, in the broader, in the discipline of ecology and conservation biology, there's a recognition that there is no part of the world that is untouched by people. There isn't like nature absent humans. And the future is going to be more and more impacted by global climate change and all sorts of things. So the future ecosystems that are going to be on this planet are probably a lot of novel ecosystems that have never existed in the past. And instead of like the sort of our knee-jerk nostalgic historic way of conserving, which is just keep the things as they always have been in nature, recognizing that things are changing and things are going to change, and we need to view every little plot of land, whatever species happen to be there, as those are the species that are there, and they have certain values. They perform ecosystem services no matter where they came from. In the case of the multiflora rose thicket, I think you're referring to like the last chapter when I'm talking about this orchard, which is this invasive thicket that, we might all want to just cut down because there's no natives there. But at the same time, it's providing habitat for bobcats and fishers and all sorts of predators that we have some interest in protecting. And so there are values associated with any ecosystem. It's doing things. It's part of the flow of nature. And we can use species for certain purposes, and we can, maybe natives are, they do support more bugs, they do feed more chickadees, in
yes
studies, but have shown this, but the non-natives also can play a role, and just mowing them down sort of as a knee-jerk reaction may not always be the right choice. And it all comes from our values and what we want to see around us,
and what we probably also really, if we sit and really think about it, what's going to happen next, and is there going to be stewardship, or are they all just going to come back anyway? But there's a lot of next steps in those decisions.
What are we replacing it with?
Right. So you said you're in Western Massachusetts when you're not up at school in Maine teaching. And what is your home property? What's its history and hydrology? What kind of place is it? Tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so that place, it's, as I mentioned before, it's set into this hill slope that the house itself is below glacial lake level from Lake Hitchcock 10,000 years ago, and above it is all sort of glacial till. It's a unique little mountain that has some old growth and some hemlock forests, some of which are getting attacked by woolly adelgid. And then the yard itself, though, is historically, it was a cornfield before, before we moved in, long before. But and so the soil has been tilled, but it's really nice, soft soil because of the glacial history. It's right on the edge of a forest, and the forest is sort of second generations of succession, although a little further up there's older successional forests. But I don't know.
So you write in the book about something I'd never heard the expression before, but I kind of understood it, living in a rural place where a boundary, with boundaries between largish properties and so forth. You talk about witness trees. Tell us what a witness tree is, and do you have any witness trees at your place?
I haven't actually worked myself with witness trees. It's something that at Harvard Forest, the folks there did a lot of research with, and folks continue to work on. But essentially, back in the day when they were doing land surveys, the property corners, when you would do a survey at the corner, there would be a tree, what is the nearest large tree? And that would be witness to the document of sort of the property boundary. And that would be written down in the deed. And those trees would typically be left, and they would be big old trees. And the species was recorded in those deeds. And so we have a record going way back of something about the forest in place over time. So
it's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, now they put a pin in, right? They put a metal in, or just use a GPS or whatever that's called.
And they may, you know, still put some rocks and things in too. And I'm not, you know, deep in the literature. I've heard people talk about this and write about it, but yeah, but they would still record the nearest species. So
another clue that I, to the history of a place that you mentioned in the book that I never really thought about and made sense when, I think you even have a picture of it, is sometimes you said you have come upon a number of double trunked trees in one mm-hmm. place. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so typically if an oak tree was to sprout from an acorn, it would grow up one stem and it would turn into a single stem tree. But if you cut that tree down, then it'll grow stump sprouts from the edges, and those will grow up and turn into trees themselves. And so often when you see trees that are multi-stemmed like that, either two, three, or even more, that often suggests that the above ground portion was killed. And in a lot of cases, you can tell that it was logging. Like if there were a whole bunch, they were all the same age, and you can actually see the distance between those trunks would be the between the current trunks would be the sort of the edges of the old trunk, if that makes sense.
Right.
Because the sprouts would come up at the edges. So you can see a logging history. Like I think there's a picture in the book of a slope that was all cut. It was all these oaks that I think maybe 100 years ago were cut and resprouted. Not all trees do that. And there are other things that could kill that above ground leader, but often, you know, that's what it is.
Yeah, it was kind of a fun one, because it's, again, this sort of forensic bit of history. It's this indicator, but we could walk past it in a certain place and not know what it was.
It's really common too. I mean, that's the
and that's what you said. Yeah.
And that's like, for me, it's like, I'm sort of child-minded in this whole thing. And I tend to have these very simple things that I know and I look for. Like, I go into a forest and I'm like, okay, is the understory the same species as the canopy? Are there lots of split trunk trees around that look like there was a logging event? And then I'm like, okay, yes or no. And this tells me whether it seems like it was logged or it's sort of in succession in those stages still, or whether it seems more as an older forest. And there's just a few of these sort of very simple things that I tend to look at that, that are over and over again I see. So,
yeah, I mean, we just, you know, we have maybe 3-4 minutes left, and you know, I just wanted to, you know, you talked about slope, and there's the issue of elevation, which I was talking about, and so forth. And I have friends who are like expert birders. They come at it from a different perspective. They're reading the land in a different way, in a way, because I have one friend who's, you know, I said something about having grouse, and she said, and then someone else who was there said, oh, I've never seen one. You know, I only live like a mile down the road. And she said, the expert woman in the conversation said, well, that's why you said a mile down the road, because you're not at enough elevation. They don't really like, you know, and she knew exactly it, also the birds of the place, you know, in these subtle gradations of difference, right?
and with grouse, you know, too, it's like, that's when we're doing snow tracking, me and Charlie, you know, every time we're in like a white pine understory thicket or some really dense, we're like, okay, we're going to find grouse and snowshoe hare here. You know, it's like,
right.
It's like knowing where to on the landscape and things are queuing in. And that those thickets of white pine are coming from a sort of forest logging history typically. So
the animals know how to read the land, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. And up in the last couple of minutes in up in Maine, you're getting to, how long have you been at the university there?
I started remotely from Western Mass mid-pandemic and then moved up here, I guess, last year. So two and a half years or so.
Okay. And so is it a very different kind of place? Is there something you just want to tell us a little bit about just discovering that place?
I'm still getting to know it. You know, it took me decades to know the landscape of Western Mass. And I was able to teach this course because I'd lived there for 20 years and I knew all these spots. I really could tell the stories. And I think it's so important to know your place and have that deep relationship with the land, like memories of people and animals and things that you've done on the landscape. And that's how you get to understand the world. For me, I've been here 2 years and it's, you know, it's similar species. but I still feel mainly like an alien up here. And I'm sort of like getting to know it. I can tell some stories. I kind of have a couple spots, but I don't feel like I have that deep relationship yet. You know, it's a different kind of world here. So
yeah. Well, and I mean, it's beautiful. The book is beautifully written. It's called The Trees. These Trees Tell a Story. And I will have a book giveaway with the transcript of the show now over on awaytogarden.com as well. I'm learning a lot from it. It's way over my head at the beginning, but I'm starting to grasp, you know, so I love that. It's making me stretch the way that when I first read yours and Charlie's tracks and sign of insects and other invertebrates, I had no idea what I was talking about. So good. You've opened my eyes again. Thank you very much.
Hey, well, thanks so much. Yeah,
it's good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks. You too.
And it's good to talk to all the rest of you again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.